The committee will come to order. We have a quorum present yet, so we'll wait on the minutes, trying to move right along today. The Midwest Floating Island has a request for funding, and we'll present now. Would you please welcome to the committee and identify yourself?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Can you hear me, sir?
Yes.
My name is Rob Scarlett. I'm with Midwest Floating Island. On my left is Jeff Hansen, who is also with Midwest Floating Island. And in the audience, I should acknowledge Carlos Freeman, who is with the company that owns the enterprise. And thank you for the opportunity to come and present to you on this subject when you're ready, Mr. Chairman.
Ready to go. Continue, please.
We're very conscious of the time. We want to make sure there's opportunity for questions and answers. So I'll proceed. I think first thing I should do is pose a rhetorical question so you know why we're here. And the rhetorical question would be, if floating treatment wetlands are the answer, what is the question? And the question we're trying to answer with this presentation is, what is out there that is natural and biological in nature and can be used to restore lakes that have gone past a certain point where the nutrient load is causing all kinds of problems for the neighborhood and the water quality generally? This is about floating islands, floating treatment wetlands. They're also known as constructed wetlands, but they're a floating form of that. These are relatively new, although this technology has been developing over the last 10 years. It still makes it relatively new. Our business opened here in Minnesota just in April of last year, so we're relatively new on the scene. It's all about biomimicry. It's mimicking what Mother Nature does. So the fellow who invented this, who locates it up in Montana, was a fishing guide in Wisconsin, observer of where the fish are, and he started this quest for finding ways to cleaning water using natural methods by watching the fish congregate around these floating islands. And that gave him a clue that there's some reason why fish choose to hang around floating islands. And so he studied them. And you see a picture right now of a natural floating bog in the upper Chippewa flowage in Wisconsin. And that was sort of where his inspiration began. He studied how they work. You see on the left-hand side, there's a natural weaving together of root systems and other plant material to create a matrix. And on the right-hand side, what you'll see, and this is part of our story, that we're using a matrix that's made from recycled post-consumer material to actually dramatically increase the amount of surface area that's available. And it's the surface area that provides the home for the microbiology that occurs, which brings the nutrients out of the water column. The recycling is done right here in St. Paul, but there's also some product we bring in from outside the state. But the reason that Jeff here was actually the one who made that initial connection with Floating Island, they were looking for sources of recycled post-consumer material, and we have one right here in St. Paul. The Rotex, which owns Midwest Floating Island, is one of the oldest recycling companies here in Minnesota. It's a very long history. What we do with the recycled material is create a floating matrix. We can determine the buoyancy and make sure it floats. And we create the wicking holes that the plant life can be put in and to start the process. Again, here's an example of a floating island that has been vegetated. You might imagine because of the constant hydrology, the vegetation grows rather quickly and begins to work immediately to bring up the phosphorus and nitrates and other pollutants that are undesirable, the TSS. Total suspended solids. This is an example, just to give you an idea of the scale. This is not a treatment island so much as it is a piece of habitat for the Caspian tern out in this case, in Oregon. They were having a terrible problem with the terns were robbing the fingerlings from the fishermen, in a sense, so they're interrupting the process of creating fishable salmon. So they used these islands in a nearby location that was way far away from the fingerlings to attract the terns. And so the terns made a home on this acre, almost, well, this is half acre size, but others that have been built there about an acre in size. So that was just to make the point that these can be scaled up. Chepe Lake was almost an acre, 39,000 square feet, you see displayed there. In Singapore, they've done a very nice job of using these to improve water quality, at the same time create a very nice aesthetic effect, as you can see from this slide. This is actually a floating island that you're looking at. Again, and this is in Jinan, China. in Yang Ri Park, somewhere. Another, this is in the lower left side of the slide, you'll see a rectangular floating island that they put in to help treat the water, yet not interfere with the traffic that's recreational there. Another example, Lincoln Park Zoo, a little bit closer to home. In this case, they were able to avoid the annual maintenance requirements and really dramatically reduce their costs of maintenance by using these floating islands to take up those things which normally would have to be cleaned out after draining these ponds for the animals and closures in Lincoln Park Zoo. Other zoos around the country have also been using them. What jumps out here are the benefits, of course. These are unlike the regular wetlands that we're all accustomed to. These rise and fall with the water level, so they can keep doing what they do no matter what the water level is. And so they can continue to work during all seasons. And you can have more aggressive forms of this island where you add aeration or one form or another. You can use solar wind power to support that. It's a very small carbon footprint. In fact, we're adding the ability to take carbon out of the atmosphere when you grow the vegetation on these islands. So it has a number of advantages that carry over beyond water purification. This is just a quick graphic to show how the process works. And you'll see that the vegetation on top of the island is present. That adds benefit in a number of ways, as well as aesthetic appeal. But below the island is where the work is really being done. And I think this is the major discovery. There's an institute that has devoted many years to studying the biofilm and how that works to remove phosphorus and other nutrients. And 85% of the removal is attributed to the microbial activity underneath an island. Going back again to what I said about surface area, we're using these post-consumer materials to create a vast amount of surface area, more than Mother Nature might in her own best day. And this enhances the ability of the island to take nutrients out of the water. Where does it go? Of course, the oxygen is produced by the plant life on top of the island. Underneath the island, you'll see on the right-hand quadrant there, you'll see the fish underneath the island. When you remove the fish, once you've restored that lake water balance and you're fishing again, thanks to that clear and oxygenated water that comes with this process, the fish, when you remove them, are taking nutrients in the sense that were a problem and converting them into a fish. And when you remove the fish, you remove the nutrients that way. But otherwise, they stay in the island. They become part of the biomass of the island. We have a study that was done in Houghton Lake, Michigan, over a 30-year period. They studied a natural floating bog that took 94% over that 30-year period of all the phosphorus that came in stayed in the island during the period of that study. So it doesn't sort of go back in, doesn't redissolve. It just stays as part of the biomass of that island. Nitrate removal rates, these are laboratory rates, I'm quick to point out, because we don't expect to see that particular rate in most natural real-life applications, but it gives you an idea of the potential. For those in the room that may be water scientists, you'll see that as a very dramatic rate of removal. Likewise here, you'll see from year to year, day-to-day, 7-day to 14-day period, quite an increase in the removal rates from one period to the next. This is just an example, just to get the imaginations going. A fellow in New Zealand is using this technology to remove bad things that go from landfill leachate into the water. And I'll show you a quick before and after. On the left, of course, is the before, and on the right is the after. So these islands have the ability to take a lot of the mineral that has accumulated in water bodies as well as the other nutrients. And then here, some demonstrations that are still going on. We are setting out to do more demonstrations here in Minnesota, but around the world and here in the U.S., there's quite a work that has been done the last 10 years. At the center, they've got a number of different tests ongoing. Any of you are welcome to first visit there and take a look personally. One of the challenges that we're trying to respond to, of course, is the effect of lakes, what happens to lakes that are surrounded by agricultural activity. And this, of course, is where this whole idea started in Shepherd, Montana. And this is an example of the streams that were feeding into the Yellowstone River before they intervened with this particular method. This, what you're seeing now, is a large, sort of the hyped-up version of the floating treatment wetland. We call it the Leviathan, and it involves aeration, so that you're adding aeration and circulating the water at the same time you're allowing the biological activity to occur underneath the island and on top of the vegetation. They can be moved at different sizes, different shapes. This is just one example of a shape. And we're in the process right now talking to local governments and local organizations concerned with water quality to set up several demonstration sites here in Minnesota to prove their worth in this environment. This is another example of one version of a leviathan with a pump house built onto it. In the wintertime, they continue to function, as I mentioned, as long as you have access to unfrozen water underneath the island, underneath the ice, the biological activity continues. And then again, here, the values. Habitat, you can grow vegetables if you choose to on these islands. But on the right-hand side, I think the founder of the organization, Bruce Kanya, loves to say it's all about the fish. That's where he started in this. And again, you'll see that that is part of that process. You create a possibility of feeding these fish with the foods that are created by the microbes, and then you start that chain all over again. And when you fish, you remove. Since this is Minnesota, the land of Gavia Immer, we also should point out that we use the same material to create floating nesting platforms for loons. Hopefully, as many as possible returning from the Gulf this year. I know there's some question mark about that. And we've been working with people around the state to put these out there so that the loons will have a durable year-round type of platform to return to. Again, it's the fish. The fish are a very good indicator of the health of a body of water. And these are some examples of projects all around the world. There are about 4,000 of these biohavens scattered throughout the world, and a growing number. Here in Minnesota, these are just, I just listed a few of the organizations we've been talking to locally since we opened last spring. And we're, again, sorting through these to see where we might do some demonstrations. We worked closely from the beginning on the recycling side with the MPCA. They were very interested in seeing us do the recycling part. And then when they learned that we could also use this technology to clean water and in impaired lakes, they became very interested and have been very supportive and would like to see some of this testing done and like to see the data, of course. And that's where we're here. And with that, Mr. Chairman and committee members, we'll stand for questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Scarlett, I'm not sure what your request is.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Scarlett.
Representative Murphy, we came here with the expectation, of course, of first of all informing you. We're not an applicant ourselves. We're working with state agencies, of course, who have an interest in seeing the testing done. We have proposals into local governments and local community watershed districts. It's our expectation that they, in some cases, would be looking for specific funding through the normal channels that may end up here in this committee. And so that's why we're here today. I hope that's a satisfactory answer, Mr. Chairman. Yes, and on the economics and on the proposal status, I can read. With your permission, Mr. Chairman, Jeff can.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to comment on
identify yourself for the record, please.
Yes, Jeffrey Hansen with Midwest Floating Islands. Rob, if I could have to go back to the previous slide. On this list, there's several, many different watershed districts across the state of Minnesota that have inquired about demonstration projects to demonstrate how this technology can be effective in lake restoration and removing phosphorus nitrates. Each of these organizations look for funding. Our purpose of presenting here is to say, hey, this is a concept that there is available, and that as these different organizations define that indeed it is an applicable place, can be monitoring it, can be testing to determine those results, we believe it's a very worthwhile project to be proving out how this technology can contribute to improved water quality in Minnesota through these different types of organizations that are responsible for the water quality within their watersheds.
I'll come back to you in a second, Representative Murphy, but just let me maybe help it out a little bit by saying we have a request that's coming to us in the form of a bill for $10 million to clean the phosphorus out of a lake in southern Minnesota. And this is a process that for many millions of dollars less could do the same thing. We're talking maybe a few $100,000 rather than $10 million. And what I'm doing is just giving this asking them today to give this as an example of what maybe could be done in the future if this is found to work the way they're saying it does. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hansen, then, is Midwest Floating Island a business, a corporation?
It is a business, a local St. Paul business, yes, that is a licensee of this technology from Floating Island International out of Montana. We provide that as a tool.
Are you deep in thought, or do we have a question coming?
No.
I'm trying to think of what the correct question would be about. So it's a St. Paul business that's part of a Montana business.
No, the
Mr. Hansen.
Yes, sorry. The Montana business is the inventor of the concept of floating islands. Midwest Floating Islands is the manufacturer, assembler, launcher of those here in the Midwest, in Minnesota. We're the implementer of that technology here.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Hansen, is that a private business or a public business?
Midwest Floating
Island. Mr. Hansen.
Midwest Floating Island is a private business.
Family owned or more than one
Murphy.
Owner? Mr. Hansen.
Representative Murphy, it is Mr. a family
Hansen.
Business. Arliss Freeman here represents that family here.
Mr. Scarlett.
If it will help, Mr. Chairman, for the purposes of answering that question, it is a Minnesota corporation. It's an LLC. It's currently wholly owned by the Freeman company. The Protex company is, we're a subsidiary, in a sense, of a Minnesota corporation as well. It's an 85-year-old company that's been in recycling for all that time.
Representative Wagenius, do you have a question?
I'm looking at the lab results where it says reduce phosphorus. Never mind the rate. I assume you mean if the phosphorus is taken up by the plants, but the plants die and go back in the water. So does that mean that you mow the plants and take the stuff off?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Scarlett?
The 85% of the uptake is by the microbial activity underneath the island. The plants add value. They do about 15% of the work by taking it through the root system. But the microbes, this is the real novel invention in the sense of discovery, that the microbial activity does 85% of the removal. And once it's removed, it stays as part of the biomass. It does not return to the water body. And except for the fish, of course, who eat the plant life that it grows along with the microbes, then that becomes part of the fish, and when you fish the fish, of course, you remove some more of the phosphorus.
Okay, if I could.
Okay, Representative Wagenius, one more question, then we have to talk to the mic a little bit more, would you please?
Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so the assumption that is that the microbes stay alive and just keep this forever. So let me move on to the next thing. One of the concerns we've had in this legislature is the leaching from plastic. Bisphenol A comes to mind. Tell me about the testing for endocrine disruptors getting into the waters.
Mr. Chairman, may I?
Mr. Hansen.
Yes. That's a very valid, very good question, and the types of plastics used, types of recycled plastics, are very important in that. Bisphenol A, and that come from specific types of plastics. The types we're talking about here are PET, which is from the water bottles, and that is a type that's been proven to not have that, as well as polypropylene, which is also one of your most basic ones that's often used for food containers and different things. Those types of plastics have been widely proven to not have those types of leaching problems with them. We are not using any of the polycarbonates, PVCs, or other types that are known to have those leaching problems.
Thank you. And we have to move on to appreciate this. Once again, this is some information for us to see what might be possible. We'll talk more later. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members.
Thank you. The mic noise, I don't know where that's coming from. Perhaps one of our pages went to fix it. Is that right? If it happens again, check your cell phones or whatever. I don't know what the problem is. Okay. Next item, the Clean Water Council budget recommendations. Come on down. Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself before you speak? And you've got about 15 minutes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, my name is, and committee members, my name is Keith Hansen. I'm one of the business representatives on the Clean Water Council and the current chair of the council. I've been on the council since about 2008 to the present time. And with me is my one of my colleagues, Scott. I'll let him introduce himself. And Scott's going to lead the presentation off with an overview of the council, and then I will present the budget recommendations.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Scott Hazy. I represent the statewide farm organizations on the council. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today to inform you about the work of the Clean Water Council. Today we'll give you an overview of the history of the Clean Water Council, as well as to talk to you about the council's 2010 legislative report and budget recommendations for fiscal year 12-13. We'll close out the presentation by talking about the upcoming council priorities. So how and why was the council formed? It all goes back to the waters in our state. As you know, the Clean Water Act requires states to assess and clean up the lakes and rivers. PCA is a responsible agency. Through the agency's efforts over the past decade, they found roughly 40% of the state's water bodies are impaired. PCA estimates that more than $3 billion would be needed to assess, study, and restore our waters. In 2002, the Office of the Legislative Auditor issued a report that the state would need additional tools, resources, and assistance in developing TMDLs for the waters to meet the CWA mandate. After hearing the PCA's estimate and the auditor's report finding, in 2004, the legislator directed the PCA to work with the stakeholders to develop strategies to implement the impaired water program and any specific recommendations of funding priorities. The stakeholder group came to be known as the G16, a diverse group of representatives from agriculture, environmental, conservation groups, businesses, state and local governments, and others who came together, united by a shared goal to create a statewide program to assess and clean up the state's waters. The group developed the Clean Water Legacy Act. As you remember, when the Clean Water Legacy Act passed in 2006, it required all levels of government to work together to reduce the duplication or contrary efforts. The legislature stresses efficiency, cooperation, and use of the existing program and resources. Under the same legislation, the Clean Water Council was formed to advise on the administration and implementation of the Clean Water Legacy Act and to foster coordination and cooperation among public agencies. The council membership is extremely diverse. Members are not to be registered lobbyists. As of January 2011, 16 members are active. And we have two open positions right now. We have rural counties and cities, and also our tribal representative has never been filled. The next page, you see our representative membership. Our mission. The Clean Water Council provides advice to the legislative and executive branches of government on the administration and implementation of the Clean Water Legacy Act and facilitates coordination between all stakeholders, playing a role in achieving clean water for all Minnesotans. The Council fosters coordination among public agencies and private entities to ensure cooperation with relevant plans and programs, prioritizes strategies for TMDLs, restoration and protective activities, develops appropriate process for expert scientific review, and develops education and participation strategies for citizens and stakeholders. Council is organized in three ways. We have the steering committee. Clean Water Council has a steering committee which develops monthly meeting agendas for the full council as well as considers other administrative or management issues as directed by the council. It is accountable to the full council. Budget and Outcome Committee prepares initial input on budget recommendations to the council, reviews existing measurable outcomes information to show effectiveness of accomplishments, is accountable and advisory to the full council. Then the ad hoc work groups, smaller ad hoc work groups, take on specific and timely tasks for the council, often doing research and making recommendations on key policy concepts. The Clean Water Council recommends a plan for implementation of the Clean Water Legacy Act in its biennial report. The plan addresses general procedures and timeframes for implementation and includes a more specific implementation work plan for the next fiscal biennium and a framework for this setting priorities to address impaired waters. The council submits a revised implementation plan by December 1st of each even number year and includes activities for which money has been or will be spent for the current biennium, the activities for which money is recommended to be spent for the next biennium, and the impact on economic development on the implementation of the impaired waters program. Now we'll turn it over to Keith now for the second part.
All right. Thank you, Scott. What I'd like to do here is give you a general overview of how the council developed the fiscal year 12-13 budget recommendations that were presented to the legislature and to the governor. We began the process probably back in March when we requested that the agencies come to the council with the various types of programs that they would like to see funded under the Clean Water Council's budget recommendations. The council or the Budget and Outcomes Committee then had a number of different meetings with the representatives from the agencies to work through what the overall scope and programmatic aspects of their recommendations. We went back and forth several times on that, had individual meetings with each of the individual agencies, and as a final outcome, developed a draft budget for the presentation to the full council back, I think it was in September of 2010. And then based on that recommendation, with the full council, we fine-tuned that with the budget numbers and then had a public review process where we had requested non-council organizations to provide some feedback. And based on that information that we got back, we got two or three really good comments, and we further allocated some of the unallocated funds that we had. Overall, the process when we first started, the agencies came back with about $186 million worth of budget recommendations, and our goal was to try to get that down to $176.458 million. And that number was derived from the Office of Management and Budget as what the revenue projections were going to be back in February of 2010. So that was our goal. We finalized the budget report at our November meeting, and then according to the requirements in the Clean Water Fund, we distributed that to the committee chairs and to the governor's office, and then also to the new committee chairs and the governor's office in January of 2011. Overall, this gives you an idea of where the funding is. We funded basically seven different programmatic areas that cover a wide range of the agency budgets. As I mentioned earlier, it's $176.485 million. And the items in green represent what we consider are going to be on the ground activities. So 67% of the council's recommendation are going to go to the projects in the field to actually improve overall water quality and to for preservation of existing water quality. The two items listed in yellow, the watershed planning strategies and the monitoring assessment, represent approximately 25% of the budget, and these are Clean Water Act requirements. These are things that the agency, specifically PCA, is required to do under the authority granted from EPA. The blue area, the drinking water protection, we're required to have a minimum of 5% of our funding allocated to drinking water protection. That the recommendations that are in front of you today represent approximately 8%. So that's the big picture overview of it. What I'll do now is I'll get into some of each of the individual programmatic areas that we're funding. From a watershed and restoration, which is basically the old TMDL or total maximum daily load, item that was in previous, what our previous council recommendations, and now protection strategies. We basically have felt that we need to look at restoration and protection all as one unit. So we've incorporated protection into the overall restoration strategies that are under the agency budgets. Approximately a little under $23 million are allocated primarily to PCA and DNR to develop these overall strategies. Drinking water protection represents about $14 million, spread over a number of different agencies, PCA, DNR, Department of Ag, Department of Health, and the Met Council. It's basically, these funds are to enhance ambient water monitoring network, including nitrates and water supply type planning. Non-point source implementation, approximately little under $70 million, primarily going towards the Board of Water and Soil Resources, PCA, and the Department of Agriculture. These are basically for cost share programs. These funds are highly leveraged, anywhere from 2-to-1 to probably 4-to-1 leveraging dollars that are available through EPA or various other funding sources that would be out there. So this is a keystone to getting the on-the-ground activities in place. There is the other side of that is the point source implementation, primarily PFA funds and some for MPCA, a limited amount. I think it's under $2 million for PCA, basically to address the requirements that are coming out of the restoration and protection strategies that are placed on municipalities. So this money is, again, leveraged to address the cleanup within the various types of waters, but strictly from a point source perspective. Education and civic engagement, a little under $1 million, primarily for PCA and for the Board of Water and Soil Resources. From a civic engagement standpoint, this involves putting some local capacity out in the field, such that those individuals that want to access clean water funds have got the technical resources to help them establish their overall proposals for grants and loans that might be available. Applied research and tool development, a little under $13 million. This is an area where we've had some, I wouldn't say differences, but the council's budget is different than what you're going to see from the agencies, because what we did is we tried to put everything that related to research and tool development into one pot, and it basically has identified those types of things in this area. So if one would go back to the previous allocations, this number is up about $4 or $5 million from where we were in the previous biennium. But it basically, these are the things that are going to be needed to help the locals implement water quality and restoration and protection strategies. And then the final item is the Clean Water Oversight, $25K for the Legislative Coordinating Commission to deal with either audits or being more transparent to the general public. It's something that the legislature looked at in the last biennium, and we've carried that through. Overall, our breakdown by agency looks a lot like this from an agency perspective. I know from looking at the governor's proposal, it varies a little bit from where the Clean Water Council is. And then finally, I just want to talk a little bit about our up-and-coming priorities. One of the first things that I think that we've recognized from a public review and comment standpoint is that the council believes we need to do a better job of going out into the greater Minnesota and get feedback from the various organizations as to what the council types of programs should be funding, and to provide more feedback. So we're going to, in our February meeting next week, we're going to be looking at a proposal to improve our overall public review and comment. The other priorities, funding, targeted implementation, and local capacity are two of the focus areas that are included in our current budget package, as is groundwater and the other things that I've already mentioned. So overall, our goal is to try to improve program coordination and efficiency, as Scott has mentioned, as far as the goals and the mission of the Clean Water Council, and to see what we can do to help improve that overall coordination. And with that, I'll open it up for questions and from the committee.
Well, thank you. Representative Wiginius.
Thank you. I don't see any money in here that is tagged for, and I read your report, and I didn't see it either, the Geologic Atlas folks. And I was wondering what your discussion was that came about that you decided not to put any money there.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Hansen.
Representative Wagenius, when we went through the discussions with the agencies, particularly DNR in this situation, it was our understanding that there is current funding available to continue with the Geological Atlas process. I suspect that when we get into the fiscal year 14-15 budget recommendations, that Geological Atlas stuff is coming back. But there was our impression that there is current funding available.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, there is funding, but what we are on is a, at best, 25-year track to get the job done. And so on surface waters, we're on a 10-year track, which I think is appropriate. But on groundwater, we are on a 25-year-plus track. So when we are looking at waters, everybody knows that groundwater and surface water intermix. And if you don't understand groundwater, you don't understand surface water. So it seems that we're off track, and I was hoping you would be getting us back on track.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hansen.
Representative Wagenius, you raise a good point. One of the things that, and when you go back to look at our upcoming priorities, the groundwater aspect of it, that's something that we think we need to further do some further work with from the agency's perspective. And we need to do a better job of coordination. I don't know, Scott, if you want to add anything to that.
Mr. Hashi.
Mr. Chair, I don't really have anything to add to that. I think we have to look at more closely, like you mentioned. And I know some counties are through with theirs already, like our Carver County's done with it already. So.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Well, Carver, good. But we are having water problems in some counties that don't have atlases. Mm-hmm. And that points out that we probably need them even faster than a 10-year cycle. On the Met Council, you put in $1 million for the whole metropolitan area. And last year, we put in $4 million specifically for groundwater, for unstressed wells, to figure out actually what was going on in our groundwater, not modeling, but the actual results. It needed $4 million more, and I was expecting to see that in the proposal. So can you help me out why that was not done?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Hansen.
Representative Wagenius, from a Met Council's perspective, when we had our discussions about their level of funding, that was the level of funding that they thought they could handle and was adequate for what they needed to do during the next biennium. So we basically took what we got from Met Council and moved that forward.
Representative Wagenius.
I could, Mr. Chairman, but it's not the Met Council that does the groundwater monitoring, it's DNR. Met Council does not have a very robust groundwater plan. They're only planning for people who live until 2050, so anybody that's born today is out of their plan. So it's DNR who took over and said, we don't know actually what's happening into the groundwater in the metro area, so I see that as a problem. Would you share that as a problem if we started a monitoring system and there's no money here to complete it?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Hansen.
Representative Wagenius, I think I understand that that aspect of your question relates back to the Geological Atlas. Am I correct in that thinking?
No.
No. All right. Then it's something I think that we could probably talk with you offline on to see where we could to get a better understanding of what you're basically after.
Well, let me.
Rosa Borghese, we wrap it up. We have to move on. But
okay. Well, I think it's important that everybody understand that in the metropolitan area, we know that the water levels are dropping, but we don't know much about it. So what DNR proposed was to have unstressed, that is, wells that are not used for pumping water, but wells that could actually just monitor the level of the water in the metropolitan area, in the aquifers in the metropolitan area. We funded them at $4 million in the last go-round, and that was about as much money as they could use for the first go-round, but that was only half of what they needed. So the second go-around would be coming up in this legislative session. And there's very little money here for the metropolitan area, so it surprised me that that one was dropped too.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hansen.
Representative Wagenius, when we had our meetings with DNR, that was not raised to the council as a priority funding level for this next biennium. Therefore, it was not taken under advisement from the council's perspective.
Okay. We'll talk.
Okay. Well, we'll, I'm sure, be chatting with you more later.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, members.
We do have a quorum now, and Representative McFarland, have you had time to peruse the minutes of the February 16th meeting, and would you like to move their approval?
I will move those minutes.
Is there a second? Don't need to do that. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Thank you. The bill we have before us is House File 471.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. I would like to move 471 for possible inclusion at a later date for a possible bill, or a bill that will include
possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know, Mr. Chair, if you wanted to take, I think when the way we left it at the last meeting, we had just gotten through the presentation and hadn't taken any questions.
Right.
Do you want me to, I have a couple of authors amendments, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. I think what we'll do is have you move your author's amendments and then take comments, questions from the audience, or comments from the audience. Members can have questions and comments after we have got the bill in the form that you wish.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what I would first like to do, Mr. Chair, I don't know if Representative Wagenius, I have an A6 amendment, but actually Ms. Taylor has drafted, there was some discussions at the Legacy Committee meeting yesterday, and then Ms. Taylor had taken some of the ideas discussed at Legacy and drafted what's labeled as the A8 amendment. And I believe the page may have just passed it around, or maybe it hasn't even gotten around yet, unfortunately. Sorry, members.
So you're offering the...
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could have a little liberty here, what I'd actually... This amendment's not been out, but I did share it with Representative Wagenius, and if Representative Wagenius thinks it's in the spirit of what the A6 was, but makes it a little better, I'd rather offer the A8. But if we feel it would be better to wait on that change, I can just do the A6, and we could do the A8 when the bill comes back. So I guess, Mr. Chair, if it's all right, I'd like to defer to Representative Wagenius, her thoughts, because I don't want to blindside the other side.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McNamara, if the question is this in the spirit, I would agree that it is in the spirit of the A6 amendment. And it is something that we should talk about. I have a worry about line 2.3, where it says to compensate for costs incurred by local units of government in which the state lands lie. I think we have to do something there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I think we're on the same page, Mr. Chair, because that language is actually in both amendments. So I would prefer to move the A8. I think it's a little better amendment. Representative Wagenius's question, and I think, Mr. Chair, if it's okay, maybe I'll ask Mr. Becker if he's got some thoughts along the lines of this A8 amendment, because he was at the LaSard Council when I first made the presentation, and then we could get to Representative Wagenius's concerns, because there's a number of concerns. I will say, members, and to the members in the audience, I probably should first, I'm sorry, I should explain the gist of this amendment. This amendment is very substantial, members, in scope and future decisions around the LaSard Outdoor Heritage Council, potentially could reach to the Parks and Trails part. What this amendment does is it says if you're going to buy money, this amendment just deals with LaSard. The reason I mentioned parks, because it came up in LaSard, that maybe that would also is something the parks part of the dedicated funding could be involved in. What it says, and I'll use a simple analogy here, that I'll do two things, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the liberty. If we were to take my situation and my family decided to move into a bigger house, we sit around the kitchen table and we say, you know what, the house on 7th Street's not quite big enough, or on 5th Street, we should move into the one on 7th Street. That's a true story, Mr. Chair, from 30 years ago. And when we moved to 7th Street, 6th Street, excuse me, I'm getting my streets mixed up. I grew up on 7th Street, I moved to 5th, and then we ended up on 6th. So we moved from 5th Street, looking at moving to 6th Street. We sat around the kitchen table and said, you know what, the house is bigger, we think we can afford it, the taxes are going to be higher, it has a larger roof, more plumbing, but we think it would be a good idea for us to move, and we think we can afford those additional expenses. I think we not only included the original purchase price, which was larger than the house we were leaving, but also the maintenance that I talked about in the cost of the roof and the plumbing and the taxes. The reason I bring that back now to the land purchase, I think when people voted, and now the whole state of Minnesota has the Outdoor Heritage Amendment that says we're going to buy or spend money in outdoor heritage, including buying land, that not only did it include this new land that we're going to buy, in which there is $28 million worth in the bill in House File 471, I believe it would be prudent to say, you know what, we should pick a number. I picked 20%. It's certainly subject to discussion, and I think it will have great discussion, that should be set aside for the long-term costs that are associated with the purchase of that land. Because as we talk about not wanting to supplant, I think we have to be honest that if we're going to buy more land, we should also recognize there's long-term costs both in the management of that land and long-term lost revenue at local units of government that no longer are maybe going to collect taxes. That's the spirit of the amendment, Mr. Chair, and it's something that Representative Wagenius and I, Representative Dill, Representative Drazkowski, those are four different legislators, usually coming from four quite different directions, but we've all got concerns about how we're going to pay for these costs, and this amendment's not perfect by a long shot. It needs a lot of work yet, and so that's the spirit that I offer it. I'm not sure, Mr. Becker, if I probably missed a lot. I don't know if Mr. Becker has thoughts, but otherwise I would stand for questions. And it would be the A8 amendment that I would like to move, Mr. Chair, just to put that's my amendment proposal at this time.
All right. Representative McNamara is moving the A8 amendment. I think everyone has a copy of it. You get it in the form, his bill in the form that he wishes. Is there any more discussion on it? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It's carried. Do you want to do your other amendment then too?
Yes, Mr. Did you want to discuss the bill?
With one more amendment and we'll have the bill in the form that he wants it.
Mr. Chair, it would be the A7 amendment.
You're moving the A7 amendment.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, I think what I'll do, I'll talk generally about what's in the amendment, and it was a number of things, and actually I'm going to screw it up. I'm going to let Ms. Taylor, if she would, she drafted the amendment. It includes a number of things, and I'll ask Ms. Taylor. Ms. Taylor doesn't need to take the political fire for the amendment, but she can explain it.
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm talking to the A7 amendment. What I'm going to do is point out what doesn't remove some vegetation seed requirements. Lines 1.12 is just a technical amendment that would actually put a purpose for the Trout Unlimited appropriation. Lines 1.19 through 1.23 provide a $10,000 appropriation to the LCC for the website. The last line, 1.27, deletes a requirement that grantees contact the Conservation Corps of Minnesota. And then on the back, section 2.3 repeals some definitions related to native prairie that are in chapter 84.02. And then the rest of it that I did mention all relates to a single provision that would require project recipients to receive or to meet certain requirements to use native ecotype when possible, and this just removes the related language.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am going to raise a lot of objections to this amendment, but first I would like to know if it's the council. Did the Heritage Council change its mind and say that they did not want to plant seeds of a local ecotype?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Becker.
Representative Wagenius. The council recommendation had the language on ecotypes in it when they passed it 11-1.
Representative Wagenius.
So this is a proposal to lower standards when the council had higher standards. Do I have that correct?
Representative McNamara?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, the language that I'm removing, I think, is not necessary. It's different than the science that's used throughout the industry. I don't think it's it's working in a practical standpoint. We're just relying on industry standards. The reality out on the landscape, I don't think the current way it's drafted is workable and is realistic.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, are we going to have testimony from DNR and Bowser who are using these standards and seem to have no trouble with them?
Representative McNamara.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I'm open to that, but I would strongly disagree with not having any problems, because out on the landscape, the reality is this is not happening. If you go out and visit on the landscape, it's not reality today to be able to get local seed sorts within 25 miles. Not only not realistic and available, it's not necessary. And I'm open to, if either Bowser or DNR want to testify, that they're certifying that every project that's being done across the state of Minnesota, someone's checking the bags and looking at the seed varieties and making sure the source came within 25 miles.
Representative Wagenius.
The language in this bill does not require that seeds come from within 25 miles. And perhaps Mr. Becker could tell me or I can find it. But that's not the law. The law of 25 miles is in another, that you're repealing, is in another piece of DNR and does not apply to this. The piece that applies to this is, okay, I think I'm going to find it.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Becker.
Line 18.
Oh, I found it. It's on lines 18.14 is the law that applies, and what that says is, to the extent possible, a person conducting a restoration with money appropriated must plant or sow seeds of only local ecotypes native to Minnesota, and preferably of a local ecotype, there's no 25 miles in here, using a high diversity of species from as close to the restoration site as possible. And it must protect existing native prairies, grasslands, and forests, and other aquatic systems from genetic contamination. There is no hard and fast 25-mile line here. This is saying, to the extent you can do it, do it. So you are saying, no, you don't even have to do that in this amendment. You can import seeds from outside of Minnesota, and you can contaminate genetically, and it's okay. So I don't think that's okay, and science does not think that's okay. And so what I brought with me, since I had the opportunity, if a page would want to help me out here. Do we have a page?
The page?
Disappeared.
Okay.
I can answer.
I think it's important to give scientists an opportunity to weigh in here, and these are scientists. These are the best scientists preserving and conserving our native species in the United States, and they have written letters. I think this was 3 or 4 years ago. To say that what Minnesota was doing was a good thing to do. And so if members can have copies of these letters, and since nobody's had time to digest them and we don't have testimony since we just got these this 24 hours ago, I think it would be helpful if we did not pursue this amendment, because it doesn't say anything. It is lowering our standards, saying it's okay to genetically contaminate. That's not a good thing. And it's okay to bring in seeds outside of the state of Minnesota. That's not a good thing either. And I don't think that's where you really wanted to go with this. Repealing the other statutes that had 25 miles in them is one thing entirely different than saying there are no standards for any of the restorations done with this new money. And the final point I want to make, Mr. Chairman, and I hope you all have a chance to read what scientists say, our Constitution actually uses the word protect prairies. Protect prairies. Is that what we're going to do with our money?
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Wagenius has mentioned a good idea. We should see if there's folks in the audience. The amendment has been out for a while. And so if there is someone that wants to testify, I think we should give them an opportunity. Representative Wagenius, we just have a difference of opinion here and whether or not the language that we've had in statute is the correct language. I believe that it's not necessary. There's standards out there within the industry that deal with local ecotypes, with the distance that you can bring seeds from. There's industry standards. I don't think it's our job as a legislature to reinvent what those standards are and affect the reality of what's out there. You and I both want good native prairie from local seed stock. I got to be honest, arbitrarily picking a distance like 25 miles does not make sense, and I respect your opinion if you think it does.
Representative Wagenius?
Mr. Chairman, the operative language says nothing about 25 miles. It is not in what you are repealing is a statute in another part of DNR that talks about 25 miles, but it's not applicable to these restorations. What is applicable to these restorations is the very specific language on lines 1814 to 1824. This is what applies to all of these restorations. There's no 25-mile limit in there. And one of the things, I heard you earlier today say, we don't want to be caught in the 1960s and 70s. And I would agree with
I
that.
I had a good time in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, well, I did too.
Not the 60s and 70s.
I did too. But the science today is very, very different than the science in the 60s and 70s when we said it was okay to genetically mix stuff. That was the science back then. I would grant you that. But that's not current science. Current science says, and if you look, just take the first thing from the Citadel. I mean, this is a military college of the South, for Pete's sakes. And it says, we caution against using cultivated native grass varieties. And they go on to say these same traits give the grasses a competitive advantage that could result in a field with limited genetic diversity in comparison to the natives. This is current science. And if you go on and look at some of the other things from the Chicago Botanic Garden, you can look at the highlight, the bold statements, but then go down when it gets to transferring seeds may lead to reduced fitness of plants in the next generation. And they talk about a study that found that seeds resulting from mixed populations, this is only 20 kilometers apart, resulted in reduced plant fitness. So they went on to say it's advisable to use the seed of the local ecotype. They gave a specific study of a Minnesota study saying transferring seed of yellow sun drops from a distant site to a native prairie may present a threat of genetic contamination to the local native prairie yellow sun drop population. Goes on to say it may reduce the fitness of the next generation, which may increase the chance that the species will disappear from the local remnant. This is the kind of science that goes throughout these letters from the leading scientists on this in the United States. I don't think we want to lower the standards of the Heritage Council. I think that's the wrong thing to do when our Constitution specifically says protect prairies. And that's what Minnesotans want us to do.
Representative McNamara? Well, at this time, I think we'll come back to, I'll come back to you, Representative Winkler, and you, Representative Cornish. But there have been calls for members of the audience to give their opinion on this amendment. Maybe we'll let them do that, then I'll come back to you guys, okay? Unless you had something urgent.
Representative McNamara, I wish you'd just do your amendment. I mean, this day after day, this has turned out, I'm sorry, but to be the Gene Wagenius committee here with just one opinion, be counted back and back and forth, and you don't want the seeds to come out of the state, but all the opinions you got here are coming from Chicago, South Carolina, the United Kingdom, and Florida, or wherever. I think we have enough experts within our state to give us some opinions, and I guess I just would like you to take action on your amendment instead of talking about this all day.
Well, approve the bill and then we'll just leave.
Mr. Chair, if I can, I'd like to hear what Representative Winkler has.
All right, Representative Winkler.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I guess I, Representative McNamara, I'm curious about your, you referred to an industry standard and that this isn't happening on the ground. And I have a hard time squaring that with the language that says to the extent possible and preferably and as close to the restoration site as possible. I don't have any background, so I don't know what the prairie restoration industry is, and I don't know if you have any, you know, do they feel like they can't, whoever's doing the restoration can't get it done because this language says to the extent possible, or is it costing more? What's the specific concern with this language on 1814 to 1824?
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Winkler. The language on sheet 18 from 14 to 24 is mostly language that I think that's more just kind of feel-good language. There are some other things that Representative Wagini has alluded in other spots that we're going to be discussing that deal with specific distances and such. I don't think this language is necessary, and it's not practical to do on a local basis to really get down to almost neighborhoods. The reality, we have industry standards, whether they're for native seeds that are going to be for prairie or native seeds that are going to be from trees, which I'm much more familiar with. Real short distances, I got to be honest, if you're in Big Stone County, it's okay to get native seed prairie from South Dakota that's right across the river. And it may even be okay to get the seeds from the native prairie in Dakota County that has the exact same zone. They might both be 4A and the zone is very compatible, but they're 200 miles apart. I understand where Representative Wagenius is coming from, and the idea that we get seeds from an area that is compatible are important. There are industry standards out there already in place. We don't need to reinvent them with language like this. It's unnecessary is my feeling, and I guess I'd be interested to hear if there are agencies that feel this language is important and that it should stay in place. That would be something different than I'm aware of. I don't think anything really gets accomplished by the language. I understand where Representative Wagenius is coming from in wanting good local prairie. There's good reason for that. I just don't know that this, I'm sorry, I don't mean to offend Representative Wagenius, but this feel-good language in here I don't think really serves a purpose, and I apologize if that offends folks, but I just don't think it's necessary, and I don't think it's our place to be doing.
At this point, is there any member of the audience who'd like to speak to this amendment? Identify yourself for the committee, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bruce Clavin, I represent the Northern Seed Trade Association. And I'll tell you up front, I'm not prepared for the amendment today. I don't have my file, I don't have my papers, and I don't have the witnesses. I just happened to stop by here to see what was going on with the bill. I caught the representative going in. Our members support the repeal, and there are two tracks here that seem to be going on. One is the 8402 language, which is in the repealer. The other is the to the extent possible language. And going back, as I'm remembering this, as I'm standing in the back of the room, in 08, the reference to 8402 was in the bonding bill and the LCMR bill. In 09 and 10, that was replaced with the to the extent possible. I think it's on page 18. And what the growers have told me is they have trouble bidding jobs with the to the extent possible. They don't know how to do the bids because they don't know how far away they're going to be from the seed source. And they were supporting the repeal of 8402 because they're in subdivision 2, I think it was. It was a 25-mile or a county restriction so that the grass seed that comes from Polk County couldn't be used for restoration in Big Stone, I think, is an example. It's too far away. And so they had trouble with that. So I know they support the amendment. There are some issues about the to the extent possible. That's not in front of you right now. In terms of the science, I also recall from the guys that they have a letter, and it's in my file somewhere, from the University of Minnesota. And I forget who it was from. I think it was, I can't remember, I shouldn't say. That there was no science to support the restrictions. So I can certainly generate those letters for you and copy them off and provide to the committee. But we had that from the University of Minnesota. And again, I'm kind of punting. You asked for folks that would be in support, and our members are in support of the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Clavin. Any questions? Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I'm familiar with the letter from the University of Minnesota. It was from Nancy Elke. And she signed on, I'll pass this out to a study called Genetic Variation in Three Native Plant Species Across the State of Minnesota. And in the conclusion of the study, it says, but there is increasing empirical support from other common garden studies on native species for using only seed in the vicinity of restoration. One recommendation, without further information, is to use seed from as close as feasible and match the environmental conditions from collection site to the site to be restored. So, yes, that was from her, and this is from her, too. And just to make sure that everybody gets a chance to read that, I'll have a page hand that out, too.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Clavin, I just wonder if you could elaborate on your comment about it not being easy to bid on things because you don't know where it is.
Sure, and again, Mr. Chairman, I'm completely subbing for the guys that would be if we had a bill or something. When they bid jobs on seed, Bowser's putting out a contract for a prairie restoration somewhere. They would bid on the job because they're the ones that grow the seed. And this mostly comes from the northwest part of the state where it's cooler climate. And so there'll be a seed mix for a DOT right-of-way or something. They bid the jobs. And to the extent possible, they don't know how to bid them because there's not enough concreteness to them. I know Bowser has developed some guidelines. I don't know what they are.
Representative Winkler.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Clavin, it sounds like it'd be easier to have a mile limit then.
Mr. Chairman,
even if
Mr. Clavin,
I know one of the things we had in a committee once was the NRCS standard of being 200 miles maybe or 250. That's what I think it was referenced as the industry standard. That's what NRCS, the National Conservation Resource Service, uses when they do CRP land and so forth. I wish I had my stuff here, Mr. Chairman. I have none of my papers with me today.
Representative McNair.
Mr. Chair, in full disclosure, I just wanted to go back to Representative Wagenius. The repealer does repeal the 25-mile. I thought it was in there, but I was confused. Just for members, 8402 says, best management practice for native prairie restoration means using seeds collected from a native prairie within the same county or within 25 miles of the county's border, but not across the boundary of an eco-type region. That's part of what I'm repealing, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Comments? Anyone else from the audience? Are you raising your hand, Representative Winkler, or just looking eager?
No, Mr. Chair, I guess that just being asked to vote on an amendment where, you know, we're hearing general statements that it's not happening, and we've got other letters, and we have existing law that says that we're supposed to do this. We've got the only justification from an outside testifier being that it's inconvenient for seed growers to bid on projects. And we've got the Lesage Sam's Council who supported this, so I don't see why we would support this change when it's feel-good language and there's nothing really supporting the amendment.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, the agencies are in the audience. They've declined to come down and speak to removing the amendment. And any of the agencies that aren't in the audience are aware of the amendment. So I think their silence speaks for themselves. And not only is it the feel-good language on sheet 18, it's the language I just repealed as part of the repealer. So that's in statute. It's not happening in reality on the landscape today. And so people know where I'm coming from. I'm just a regular guy trying to do the right thing. It's not happening. I'm sorry. Get out on the landscape and look at the bags of seeds. I mean, I'm sorry. They can throw their arms up, as Mr. Clavin has just said, and it doesn't get done. Or we can move forward and make sure we're doing what is already in sound science and is within the industry, and that's what I'm trying to do. The other thing is, I'm not sure, Representative Winkler, if you were here, but I think you were here when I made my motion. My motion is to lay the bill over for possible inclusion, so I would imagine the bill is going to be up, and when it comes up again, there would be potential again for discussion to discuss the bill in the shape that it will be at that time.
That's correct, Representative McNamara. Well, at this time, we have the A7 amendment before us. Is there further discussion? Representative Murphy.
Well, Mr. Mr. Chair, I think I have the discussion. What about the Conservation Corps?
Representative McNamara?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Murphy. I apologize. I think we went right over there. Ms. Taylor, did you mention it? Yes, the language that requires the DNR to send a letter and put a stamp on it to ask the Conservation Corps to be involved in each project is removed. I'm not sure if Mr. Price, former Senator Price,
yes.
I did talk to him out in the hallway. Mr. Price is here, and I'd be glad if he has comment. He probably doesn't like me removing the language, but I think Mr. Price knows my feelings towards Conservation Corps, and they're very positive, very, very good, and I want them to have an important role. Again, I just think that this language is unnecessary. I'd be surprised if Mr. Price supports it. I think he'd rather me not do this, but I'd rather let him speak, and I think it would be appropriate, if Mr. Chair, you'd give me the indulgence and that he could answer Representative Murphy's concern.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. Mr. Price, Senator Price, do you have a comment?
We go back a long way, Senator Price and I, so, and I already apologized out in the hall. I was going to reach out to him and let him know I was blindsiding him, and he didn't get my personal contact until in the last hour.
Senator Price.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Len Price, Executive Director of Conservation Corps, Minnesota and Iowa. blindsided might be a little strong, my friend Representative McNamara. We just talked about this provision out in the hall a little bit ago. I guess we'd go back to why the language was inserted originally, and it was the feeling of the committee at the time that it was a good idea to have those people who receive these funds have the knowledge that the Conservation Corps is available to do cost-effective work on behalf of these entities that do receive these funds. It's our philosophy that we're not interested at all in competing with the private sector. We only do work on private lands or on public lands, or if it's on private lands, it's in conjunction with a publicly funded program. So the original language that was inserted, the idea was to provide us with an opportunity to have collaboratives, and also for those who were grant recipients to know that we were available to do this work. It's the judgment of the committee to change this. I think Representative McNamara articulated our position would be that we would prefer to keep the language in, but if you decide to take it out, we'll live with that.
Thank you, Senator Price. Any questions of Senator Price? Representative Murphy.
No, I have a question of Mr. Becker then.
Thanks. Mr. Becker, welcome back.
Mr. Chair.
So, Mr. Becker, because you have the background of the Outdoor Heritage Council, did the Outdoor Heritage Council have some bad experience with the Conservation Corps, or did the Outdoor Heritage Council ask to have this language removed?
Mr. Becker?
Representative Murphy, the council has had no bad experience with the Conservation Corps. They looked at this language in a meeting without taking action on it yesterday and expressed no concern about it.
Mr. Chair, if I may, to Representative
McNamara.
I removed the language on my own. No one requested me to remove it. And I never, I did present my amendments at the Lessard Council yesterday morning, presented my ideas of the amendments, and Mr. Becker expressed what the council did. But I brought the amendments forward, the entire A6 and A7 amendments. Did I say the numbers right? Yeah. They were not by any interest group or any other representatives. I mean, I think other people support it, but I did it on my own, good or bad.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Murphy.
I think it's interesting that we're removing the Conservation Corps from this without you had other recipients of legacy money give testimony on how they spent the money and how they were used with the legacy money, and we still haven't had that presentation from the Conservation Corps. And yet now we're taking an opportunity away from them without any testimony. I think it's short-sighted.
Mr. Chair, I do respect
Representative McNamara.
I respect Representative Murphy's opinion, but I don't believe we are taking anything away from the opportunities before the Conservation Corps. This was a requirement that every project DNR contact them, and I'm just removing that requirement. I will continue to support DNR's efforts and other agencies, Bowser's efforts to work with Conservation Corps. It is growing astronomically under the direction of Executive Director, former Senator Price, and I think it's a good thing, and I continue to support it. And it certainly is not my hope to destroy that group by this language. I don't think it does that at all. Maybe by this discussion and raising the discussion about the group might actually help Senator Price, because if there's any efforts to reduce their funding and such, they've now got somebody on tape pretty strong in favor of them.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Becker, does the language in there doesn't give them any preference in terms of the Conservation Corps getting the work, does it?
Mr. Becker.
Chair, Representative Dill, there's no preference in the language.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dill.
If the department has to notify them of opportunities from the money, do we anywhere else in this Lizard Council have to notify anyone else in the same manner and fashion?
Mr. Becker.
Representative Dill, there are a number of places where the recipients are required to notify the council changes in the use of land, things of that sort. But nothing like it precisely like this.
Representative Dill?
Well, I think that Senator Price would tell you that there's probably people who advocate for the Conservation Corps as much as me, but I mean, I have a real passion for that. I see the good work that they do, but I'm just questioning. I'm still not confident that we need to have language in there that says they have to be notified of every project. I mean, they should know that every project is out there. They should be contacting every project proposer and letting them know what their services are. And I'm wondering if, my question would be, I'm wondering if, let's say, Ducks Unlimited or Pheasants Forever came, or Wild Turkey Federation or Trout Unlimited or any of those organizations came to Lizard Council and said, well, you know, we do some really good work, too, and we can do it really cost-effective as well, and we'd like to be in that language, you know, equally, and be notified of every single project and the availability. And that, you know, Senator Price knows, and my statement is no attack on them, because in other committees, I've supported them and defended their appropriation to the nth degree. But that's my question. What do you think that could be a possibility, that by having a language in there that others would come forward and try and get the same type of language in there?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Becker.
Representative Dill, this is a question that requires me to do some supposing and imagining, but I really can't figure out what others would do. This came into the bill, in the very first bill, and has been there since.
Okay. No more.
Well, thank you. The amendment A7 is before us once again. There's no further discussion. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Amendment carries. And now the bill is in the form that the author wishes. We've added two amendments to it. Is there further discussion from the audience? Representative Dill.
Looking back at Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, looking back at the A8 amendment and lines 2-2 through 2-4, I understand on 2-2 the cost to pay future restoration and enhancement of the lands purchased in fee, and then on 2-3 it talks about to compensate for costs incurred by local units of government. Let me ask you: is the intent of that portion on 2-3 and 2-4? Would that intention be as one of those compensate for costs mean the absence of PILT payments, if in fact PILT payments were not forthcoming?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill.
Representative McNamara.
We're trying to work with an Attorney General's opinion from last year that says legacy sales tax money can't be paid to local units of government as PILT. We've got council working to see if there's some language. Representative Dill, you've brought the idea forward. Representative Wagenius and I talked about it earlier today, potentially making payments such as the federal government does under the purchase of some waterfall production areas, WPAs often referred to, where they make a lump sum payment at the time of buying the land to the local units of government. That's one possibility. This money, my intention is to compensate local units of governments, but for the cost they would incur but would not get reimbursed when the property was on the tax rolls. Trying to find a way that we can reimburse them. There are certain ways we can do it. Specifically, the Attorney General said we can't use PILT. So our hope is, as the bill is held over here, that council will look at ways to maybe even tweak this farther, work on it potentially, maybe even into next year, to find a way to set this up for maybe some permanency and do it on an ongoing basis year after year with land purchases. I'm not sure, Representative Dill, if that gets to your question exactly.
Representative Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative McNamara, I think you got to the question, so I'm going to ask a further question that you would have to probably envision a little bit. But so you give a one-time payment to a county because they had a tract of land that went from private, that was purchased with Lessard money, to public, and that we give them a one-time payment, then it would be the option of the recipient of the money, let's just say that it's, for lack of a better use, a county, to either put that money in trust on their own or to spend it on their own how they see fit. Is that how you envision this? Because frankly, that's how I envisioned it. I mean, I think that putting it in a trust so that it's perpetual to the best of their ability would be the right thing to do, but I think that's up for debate. So now I was wondering what your thoughts were on that.
McNamara.
Representative Dill, I think you laid out some options, and I like the idea of it being there perpetual. Representative Wagenius put an idea forward earlier today when her and I were talking about it that I'm hoping Ms. Taylor we'll be able to look in, and I don't know, Representative Wagenius, you probably remember it better. It was, it's along the lines, different ideas. I will say, members, this is really important stuff, how we deal with this, because I think it gets to the gist of this question again. If we're going to buy land on funds that where people now have intact, where it's an opportunity to buy above and beyond our normal budget, should we be setting aside these funds for dealing with the long-term costs? And if it's all right, Representative Dill, Representative Wagenius floated an idea today with me, and I thought it was a good one that actually Ms. Taylor could hear today.
Representative Dill?
I think Representative Wagenius would be able to answer the question better than I.
Representative Wagenius.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, Representative McNamara. I think one possibility would be to, at the time of a purchase, as part of the price we set aside for a piece of land, we set aside legal fees and we set aside restoration costs. We should also set aside a host fee for that county, but it should be a host fee that goes to the county that would have three parts, a local unit, schools, however that's structured. I don't have specifics. The money that would go to the county, and the way it would be structured is that the county could set it aside in a trust fund, or this county could ask the State Board of Investment to invest it, and receive a certain dollar amount per year. So you could do it either of two ways, under county control for the units of government in that county, or the State Board of Investment would do the investing part and have this money come out in the same way. I think it provides a good legal mechanism for getting the job done. Does that make sense to you, Representative Dill?
Representative Dill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius and Representative McNamara, I think it does. And, I mean, I'm thinking about all the time that we spent on this when you were chair of the committee and all the discussions that we've had collaboratively amongst us. And I mean, as usual, you are able to refine things better than I. I had not thought it through that far. I just know that if we are going to go on to a land acquisition program that encompasses potentially massive amounts of money and land, that we need to do something, or we're going to, you know, living the dream myself in our counties of 90, 80, and 70% public land, this is a real problem. And, I mean, there are places in this state that absolutely need a tremendous amount of additional public land to protect resources and enhance prairies and do restorations and all that. But I know that the counties and townships and school districts will have a hard time bearing that. And that's one of the reasons that I went on the bill with Representative Drazowski of no net gain, because I knew that somewhere out there has to be a compromise so that people can navigate through this. And I found out that I'm now one of the biggest anti-hunters in the state because I did that. Like I said, another committee, I have 6 hunting licenses from 6 states and 2 provinces just this year alone. But I'm now, and I, in my bill on the House floor, I passed the language that enabled the question to go on the ballot that made the Lessard. But I'm still now perceived as an anti-hunter. So what I'm trying to do is find some way to navigate this, and I'm really happy that I see this group trying to work together to find a way. And I thank you for that specifically. I think you brought up some intriguing ideas how we might do this, well beyond what I had thought.
Thank you. I have another amendment before us, the A3 amendment. Who's offering that?
Mr. Chair, I apologize, but just before we leave it, I did want to let
Representative McNamara.
I did want to let the committee know that the Lessard Council is also looking forward to council's ideas of what options are along the different thoughts of Representative Dill, Representative Wagenius, and myself. So I just wanted to let them know it is possible that the council may have some ideas going forward as they meet over the coming time while the bill continues to be held here. I'm very much interested in listening to what council ideas are as they've grappled with this idea also.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. The A3 amendment, Representative Fugini, do you move that?
I would like to move the A3 amendment.
Okay, Representative Wagenius moves the A3 amendment. Discussion.
Members, this is about accountability. One of the things that I was a definitely strong supporter of the Heritage Bill, and I expect it will come up again in 20-some years. And when it comes up in 20-some years, I want folks to know exactly I want them to have such accountability that they're thrilled to do it again, okay? So what this is to have the Commissioner of DNR approve acquisitions with this money and just determine if this fits into the DNR's precision conservation goals. Those are the things we've been talking about. So that we have had language in the Heritage Bill the last 2 times running that has the commissioner sign off. We want to make sure that a lot of this land is going to go to the DNR for long-term management, and because of that, they should have a say in what people buy in behalf of on their behalf and on behalf of all of us. Somebody has got to do there's we need always in government you want some checks and some balances to make sure that you have the most accountability that you can.
Representative McNamara?
Well, Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Wagenius. I guess I would ask Mr. Becker, if it's all right, to give us his thoughts on the amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Becker.
This is similar to language that was in the proposed recommendation for laws of Minnesota 2011. It's a little wider than what was in the recommendation. The council considered it in its final meeting of 2010 and removed it after having had it in their language for two appropriations. The purpose of the original language that the council placed in their recommendations was to avoid situations where land was bought and presented to the state to keep that was not close to other habitat land and therefore less productive or might have some sort of liability associated with it. One of the new things about this language is precision conservation goals. We support precision acquisition. Precision conservation is new to us and will require some definition from the DNR.
Representative Wagenius.
I would be happy to say precision acquisition instead of precision conservation if that would, if that, and I would incorporate that as an amendment to say precision acquisition.
And Mr. Chair?
Mr. Becker?
I've testified in this committee earlier on what how the council views that particular phrase.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, I've never served on this committee before, if Mr. Becker could let us know what that is.
Mr. Becker?
Mr. Chair, yes, the idea is to buy land near other habitat land that's managed. The idea is when buying land that's part habitat and part productive agricultural land to dispose of the agricultural land if it's not necessary for habitat purposes. It's to get precisely what's necessary for the habitat complexes in Minnesota.
Thank you. Does everyone understand on 1.9 you would remove conservation and insert acquisition?
Mr. Chair, I think with Representative Wagenius's oral amendment that this would be okay.
All right. So the oral amendment
I support it. I guess it's not my call. I support
it. No, the oral amendment then is inserted. We're back on the main amendment. Further discussion? Anyone from the audience wish to comment on this amendment? All right. Those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment carries. We have the A9 amendment. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McNamara, this has to do with easements. And
Representative Wagenius.
Yes.
Move the amendment, please.
I would like to move Amendment A9.
Okay, Representative Wagenius moves Amendment A9. Everyone has a copy of that. Discussion. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McNamara, this one has to do with easements that are acquired with the heritage dollars. And we want the commissioner to look at these easements and to see that Minnesotans are getting what they paid for, basically. You look at form and content, but look at the value of the easement. We have had problems in the past where easements have been drawn up and made, and we have not gotten what we thought we paid for. And I want to make sure that Minnesotans essentially get what they pay for. Easements are very difficult to write. I actually like easements, but it takes a very special person to write a good one, and a bad easement is throwing away people's money. A good easement does the job, and so we just want to make sure all the easements do the job. And so part of it's for DNR, and some of the, you know, Bowser gets some of the easements, so the language is just repeated. It's the same thing.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Wagenius. Thinking back to my days with Representative Osmond and then my days with you as the chair, one of the things that we dwelled on over and over and over again is the actual knowing that we have an easement, and the fact that those easements were made, they were signed, they were agreed to, the payments were made, and then things happened on the land and there was no record keeping. Do you think that we have enough assurances now in statute that record keeping is appropriate, or is there a place in this amendment where it might be appropriate to add? Does anything in this form, content, and value, does any of that cover the record keeping part to make sure that in 20 years that we still know that we have the easement?
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dill, the amendment does not. LCCMR gave DNR enough money to go through its easements, find out where they were, and actually find out where they were, what they said. And you're right, they didn't know how many easements they had, where they were, or what Minnesotans had purchased with that easement. It is my understanding that they've gotten their arms around that, and we know now what we have. Bowser has testified again and again that it knows exactly what it has. I think we're okay. We could put language in, but I assume that if the commissioner agrees in writing, that they'll keep a record of what they've agreed to.
Representative McNamara?
I'll let Mr. Becker go first, then I've got some comments.
Mr. Becker?
To Representative Dill's question, Subdivision 13 of the bill requires a filing of an interest in real property report that includes easements with the legislature, and annual attesting that easement is still there and operating. So I think we've got it in the bill.
Representative McNamara?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe there may be some folks in the audience. I've heard from some groups since this amendment's come forward, some of the folks that sometimes do work on behalf of the state of Minnesota that have concerns about this. And then also, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if either DNR or Bowser may also want to speak about this amendment. So I'm wondering if we could give an opportunity. I think some of the interest groups, Trust for Public Lands or Friends for the Mississippi, this may infringe on their ability to work on easements, and they may want to speak to it.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. Does anyone from the audience wish to speak on this amendment? Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if Representative Wagenius would yield to a question, do you have some specific examples of where heritage funds have been used for an easement and it has not turned out well?
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Torkelson, I do not, and frankly, I don't think anybody has ever reviewed any of those easements to see what value Minnesotans are getting for their money. However, not too many years ago, DNR got an easement on some potlatch land, and we spent real money for it, big money. I just can't remember how much it was. And folks who read the easement, including me, could not figure out if Minnesotans had gotten anything for the money. And in fact, it looked like we had not. So easements are difficult to write well. I don't ever want anybody to think that these are magic pieces that are easily written. Having a second set of eyes is probably very good for Minnesotans from my point of view.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe Mr. Becker just assured us that the Heritage Council has mechanisms in place to assure that these easements are properly written and enforced from year to year, or did I misunderstand his remarks?
Representative Winkler?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think Representative Torkelson is referring to Section 5 of the bill, which is what Mr. Becker referred to, which talks about creating a fund, and this is on page 28 and 29, creating a fund to monitor and enforce the easements, which I think is the secondary important role. But what Representative Wagenius's amendment addresses is actually how the easements are drafted in the first place. So I think it's great that they have this language in here about monitoring and enforcing. That's important. But if you don't have anything very good to start with, you know, you're not enforcing very much.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Beck.
For Representative Torkelson, I was referring to whether or not there was a record of the easements kept, and there is a record kept by the legislature of all easements purchased with the Outdoor Heritage Fund. I was not referring to the review of the goods received. I will point out to the committee that Chapter 16A.41 requires a state employee prior to authorizing payment to certify that the goods have been received. So there's some form of this taking place today. I think that the amendment provides more specific and ensures specific information is reviewed.
Yes. Welcome and identify yourself, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Sarah Stroman. I'm the Associate Director of the Minnesota Land Trust. I just had an opportunity to review this language as I walked in here this afternoon, and it would appear that this language would require organizations like the Minnesota Land Trust that acquire private easements that are held by a private organization, where one of those, Ducks Unlimited, is another organization, that we would be required to have DNR and Bowser review those conservation easements before we could complete them. And so just a couple of comments, if that is the case. First of all, we certainly agree with the goal of achieving high standards for conservation easements. I agree with Representative Wagenius. Easements are not difficult or not easy to write. They are a very complex conservation tool. But our goal for those high standards, we are actually one of the first land trusts in the country to become accredited under a national accreditation program that certifies we meet certain high standards for conservation easements and land trust work. I think there are already a number of standards in place. All of our easements are drafted to meet federal standards that the IRS puts forth to set eligibility for landowners who are donating conservation easements and want to receive a federal income tax deduction for those. We write all of our easements to those standards. In addition, Subdivision 9 of the bill has a number of things that easements must contain, so there are some requirements for conservation easements already contained in the bill. And then I would say also that the value of the easements, when we purchase an easement, and we do not purchase all of the easements, the vast majority of those are donated to us, but when we do purchase, the value is we have to submit those appraisals to DNR, and they are administratively reviewed as part of our reimbursement process. But as I said, the majority of our easements are donated, and we wouldn't know the value because we don't get appraisals when they're being donated to us. So that would be one question I have, is how we would meet that. And then finally, I think our concern would just be about the capacity of these two agencies to review conservation easements in a timely manner. I think we would be very concerned about unintentional consequence of slowing down the pace of conservation.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Julie Blackburn. I'm the Assistant Director for the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. And I'm here to speak to this amendment, which would make doing conservation easements through the RIM program extremely difficult. As the bill calls for on page 8, we have $13 million that we're looking to leverage with a federal program. And those program requirements meet both the federal goals as well as the state goals. So we have a process that's been in place for a number of different years. RIM has been in place for 25 years. It goes through a selection committee. These programs are implemented programmatically, so it's a lot different than other type of easement programs. We have sign-ups. We certainly cannot have our executive director signing off on every proposal when we're having a sign-off. That's contrary to the way that the entire program is delivered. And because of that, I'm not even sure how we deliver it programmatically. So it would really put the federal dollar at risk, not only for the projects that we are looking to do with this program, but possibly in the future. If it becomes too cumbersome to get through our system, we simply are not going to be really very well suited for the federal program in the future. So the sign-up in advance that we have in order to do our RIM program really isn't going to work with this kind of a requirement. In order for all of those, we have 5,600 easements right now, over 230,000 acres in RIM. In order for those easements to go out every single sign-up, we have several hundred. I just am not even sure how we would possibly manage that. So I think it would just really kind of put our entire program at a halt. And as far as the quality of the easements that we're obtaining, our easements are inspected every year, the first year, the first 5 years that they are in place, and every third year after that. They're inspected by soil and water conservation districts. They go out and take a look at it. They look at each easement, not only from the integrity of the easement boundary that's put in place and whether there's any kind of infringement on the boundary, but as well as the ecological value. Is the wetland still restored? Are the native species still there? Is that conservation easement still up to the conservation easement boundary as well as the goal that was in the conservation plan? We do that every year. Every year there's usually a couple of little tweaks. Somebody maybe mowed inside the boundary area. But other than that, in the last 2 years, we've only had one major issue that we had to work through out of all of our 5,200 easements that we have. So we believe that this is burdensome and unnecessary for Bowser programs.
Representative Winkler. Well,
Mr. Chair, I guess this is to either testify or what I don't understand about the testimony is this amendment, as I read it, says that when you're creating the easement in the first place, you have to have, and it's only when you're using it with a public appropriation. This seems to me just a mechanism for a public agency to ensure that the public dollar is purchasing an easement that has some value. So you're not talking about reviewing it in subsequent years. You're just saying when it's drafted, who is making sure that you're actually drafting a good document. So maybe you could explain how Bowser, or who drafts those easements in the first place, and how Bowser makes sure that they work.
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, as
Ms.
far
Blackburn.
As my understanding of the way that I read this, and again, I just saw it when I walked in here, is that the executive director must agree in writing to each proposed conservation easement. Well, the way that our process goes, because it's implemented programmatically, our SWCDs work with private landowners in order to get folks to sign up. We go through a ranking criteria that already identifies the ability of the project to restore hydrology, wildlife features in targeted areas. There are already criteria that are set up that meet both state goals and local goals, or federal goals, that have been established in the program, which is in statute, and it's in our program guidelines. We have a board of 20 with representatives from local units of government and agencies. They are on the board that establish the criteria of the program. So when you sign up, you have an SWCD person working with a landowner signing up, we already have the ranking criteria and all of the program goals. At that point, they are submitting an application to apply to the program. We go through the ranking and review, and after that's decided, the selection is made by and approved by our board. We know that it works because they've been in place. We've been doing this now for 25 years. And as far as personally seeing any of the results of the quality of these restorations, I've been out on them. I've been out on them in the Red River Valley. I've been out on them in Martin County. Been out on a lot of different RIM easements. And I can see the quality. We know that it's there every year. So I don't think anything's broken with our system right now. And I think to put in something like this, that in my view requires our executive director to review each one of them before it's sent out, I don't know how it works. It flips our process backwards from what we have right now.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're not trying to make your process harder. We're just trying to make it everything absolutely accountable to Minnesotans who are putting the money in the pot. So it would be easy to say for both the commissioner and the executive director or designee, someone at the agency is signing off and saying this is a good easement. So I would move to amend to say or designee on the commissioner, after the commissioner or the executive director of the board. So to make it easier, we're not trying to make it harder, we're trying to make it accountable.
Representative Wagenius, would you repeat that amendment, please?
Surely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On line 1.6, after the commissioner or designee, and on line 1.10, after resources or designee. So the person in the field for the Bowser could do that, and the deputy commissioner for lands could do it in DNR. It's just a question of making sure somebody gets the job done.
Okay. Any objection to adding that?
Mr.
Representative
Chair,
McNamara?
I understand Representative Wagenius's intentions, but I think we heard that there will be significant cost involved, and it's additional burdensome that's not necessary, and I would not support the amendment either in its original or amended form.
Further discussion? Representative Winkler?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess maybe Mr. Becker could answer this. I don't know who could, but how does this work today? You know, let's just put aside Bowser and let's put aside land trust. Just even at the DNR, if we're buying lands, who reviews the easements that are drafted? Who drafts them and who reviews the easements that are drafted to make sure that they're actually meeting requirements? Or the desired goals? It's very, I mean, it's a specific question.
Mr. Becker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I believe that the Commissioner's Office reviews the major ones. The Attorney General reviews them. The Bureau of Lands reviews them, all with various eyes and expertise. The most technical review would be from the Bureau of Lands, I believe.
Representative Wagenius, first, we'll just determine that your amendment to your own amendment is a friendly amendment, so it's included. So we're on the entire amendment here. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Currently, what easements are reviewed for in DNR, the technical, is for form and content. The question is do Minnesotans get value for their dollar? And that, so you're accepting some, you know, we're putting money out, and we want to make sure that somebody with fresh eyes says Minnesotans are getting a value for their dollar. It's as simple as that. There's no complexity here. It is being a good steward of the Heritage Fund.
Further discussion? The amendment A9 is before us. There is no further discussion. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion fails. We are now on the Bill 471 as it is amended. Any further discussion today? Otherwise, we will, from the audience, anyone? Representative Wagenius?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I will bring up two other concerns that I have with this bill. Again, there are accountability concerns. I don't have concerns with which parcel of land is being purchased or looked at, but again, I think it is important that accountability be our number one goal of what we do. So right now, there are two things that just raise red flags for me. One, that the Heritage group decided to cut in half the number of parcels that were looked at to check to see if anybody was doing a good job. They cut it in half. And then they changed the language. So the language for looking at parcels says, look at parcels that are restored. But this time, we are getting parcels that are enhanced. It's a great way to skirt around getting anybody to look at what you're doing. So right now, in this bill, and I can send this sheet around if anybody is interested, the total restored acres in this bill is 850. The total of enhanced acres is 40,406. When people don't want Minnesotans to see what's going on, then I surely want Minnesotans to see what's going on. So that's one of the issues that I have with this bill, and I hope we can remedy that. I could not see any easy remedy for that, or I would have offered an amendment. The second thing is, beyond the language that Representative McNamara put in, there are funds that can be set aside, and I think I looked out for four groups, and the four groups were under a Section 615, DNR, Pheasants Forever, Bowser, and Ducks Unlimited. And so folks who are saying, I want, don't look at what I've done, but I would like money in a slush fund. And I just don't think that's right. So those are two things that I think that this committee is responsible for, and this bill shouldn't leave the committee until we deal with those two issues. Though I don't expect it to happen today, I do expect we do need to deal with that. And I will, because I did bring extra copies someplace here, I'll just make sure the page hands them around. That is the role of the minority, to ask questions. And when we have this much money at stake, somebody's got to ask a lot of questions.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius. You're doing a good job at that. Mr. Solon?
Mr. Chairman.
You're objecting to the provision to do away with townships that Representative McNamara put in there.
Mr. Chair, we'll deal with that separately.
Okay.
For the record, I'm Kent Sulem, General Counsel with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And I just want to be very quick dealing with the A8 amendment as it was put into the bill, and thank Representative McNamara for the inclusion of that. Thank Representative Wagenius and Representative Dill for their comments and commitment to keep working on this issue. It is an issue that Ms. Garlitz from the counties and I brought forth, I believe, 2 years ago, working with Representative Murphy, actually, when she was chairing this committee. And it does go a long ways towards being able to build the support of the local units for the goals and objectives of the legacy funds. And so we do commit to keep working with those who are involved and try to perfect any language concerns. But what I really wanted to comment on was to correct what I think is a misperception regarding this alleged Attorney General's opinion. Because I have looked, I have contacted the AG's office, I know AMC has contacted the AG's office, there is no opinion. There is a letter that states starts off saying, this is not an opinion. It is an advisory letter that has a hypothetical discussion. Now, that said, I realize there are very definite limits within the confines of the constitutional amendment. But it's important as we go forward that our hands are not completely handcuffed because of some binding opinion that does not exist. There is a hypothetical, a letter that specifically says we don't grant opinions to hypothetical situations. Working within the confines of the actual language is completely legitimate and something we have to do. And I think we have done that over the years, and we pledge to keep doing that. But I just wanted to make it clear that it isn't that there is some binding opinion out there, because it does not exist. Unless something has changed, that when we've contacted the office, and I spent half an hour on the website last night trying to find this magic opinion, it simply does not exist.
Thank you, Mr. Solem. Anyone else from the audience wish to comment? Anything to conclude? Well then, members, this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill, and if you have other comments or questions, you'll get another shot at it later on. Otherwise, well, King, this case is closed.